Welcome to another episode of The Short Code, a podcast of wit and wisdom from the students at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. Here at the Carver College of Medicine on the campus of the University of Iowa, which is famous for its legacy of writing and writers, we're lucky enough to receive occasional visits from some pretty outstanding authors. Recently, during the annual CCOM Reads contest, medical students were encouraged to read author Marilyn Robinson's Gilead, a novel for which she won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for fiction. It's an account of the memories of John Ames, of his father and grandfather, all of whom were Congregationalist ministers in Gilead, Iowa. After the contest was over, we asked Ms. Robinson to visit with the students to talk about her writing of the novel.
I have never specifically set out to be a novelist. I just write novels when I have the feeling that a novel is forming in my brain, whatever that means. And during those 24 years, I wrote nonfiction. And my nonfiction is almost always research-based in some way, so that I find out there's something that you feel like there's something wrong in the conversation that is going on around you. And then you think, you know, if I look at this, then I'll be able to see what it is that unsettles me about it, you know. And I did a lot of that kind of research just for its own sake, but it almost always, you know, then if I were asked to give a lecture or to submit an essay or something like that, that's where the research went. And I enjoyed that. It was, it didn't like open the taps of prosperity for me or anything like that, but it was a very, very enjoyable. And it made me, for one thing, use the university and so on more than I might otherwise have done. It was a way of sort of living into the life that I had. In the first instance, I had, when I wrote Housekeeping, I had very strongly in my mind the character of Ruth and the character of Sylvie, both. They were very strongly present to me in that strange way. And then, 24 years passed, and I was in Provincetown, Massachusetts, out on the tip of the Cape. And I had agreed to go to the Fine Arts Work Center, where my students were, if I could do it around Christmas, because I wanted to spend Christmas there. And so I got a suite in a hotel so that my sons could come and we could all spend Christmas there. They were not married at the time. And they were late coming, and I was in this little Emily Dickinson room in an empty hotel, with this beautiful oceanic light pouring in through the Emily Dickinson windows and so on. And suddenly I had this voice in my head, and a voice for me means a whole presence, I knew a great deal about him as soon as I knew what he would say. And so I had a pen and a notebook and started writing. And the novel, the first page of the novel is the first page that I wrote, the first sentence is the first sentence. And this is true of my novels. I always write from a first page that seems to me to be weighty, pregnant, whatever the word would be, But it's nothing I can induce in myself. It's not an act of will. It's just something that sometimes occurs to me and sometimes doesn't. And you could say physiologically, I can tell the difference between when it's happening and when it's not. And if I don't have the particular sense of my present ability to write fiction, I really can't do it, and it just disappoints me if I try. It's terrible advice to give my students because I think I may be alone with this malady, But on the other hand, I think a lot of people try to regiment themselves into writing when they have to really be using their mind in another way, being receptive to their mind rather than trying to push it around,
In that sense, did the way that you portray the son just come to you, or did you have to seek out inspiration? I thought whenever I would read passages that included the son, that it would bring back childhood memories of the way I played with a cat, or the way I swung on a swing, I would stand on it, or, mm-hmm. I feel like I wouldn't remember these things spontaneously. Did you have these spontaneous memories of how children play, or did you have to actually, I have this scene in my head, but I don't know how a kid moves or how it would respond to its pet. I'm curious as to how you approached the way the child behaved. I thought it was really authentic, and I don't know, I wouldn't have remembered how I played.
It's basically memory. And then I have two children, two adults now, but two children myself. But one of the things that is very interesting to me about all this is that if you put yourself in the situation of reaching for a broader access of awareness than you normally make use of, it's there. When I wrote Housekeeping, I was living in France. I was out in the country. These little kids that lived around thought there was a great deal of novelty in having Americans living in the house. So they would come and pound on those windows, because like an aquarium, watch the Americans move, And they were very sweet, and I didn't want to be, obnoxious. And so what I did was go into a little back room and close the shutters that basically block out all light into the room. And I had a little wobbly table lamp and a pen and a spiral notebook. I was very aware of the fact that I was the only person in the universe in a dark room in France remembering Idaho. I just knew that was true. But it was so interesting because it was, I think, like, a sensory deprivation chamber or something like that, where with extraordinary vividness, I would remember things that I would not have ever anticipated remembering. A lot of it is terrain, what would grow in a certain kind of place and so on. I hadn't lived in that landscape for 20 years when I wrote Housekeeping. But I knew, I think that if we understood how actively our minds work, storing things that it's fantastic to imagine you would ever have any need for, and it's sort of like, those dreams where you're in a house and you open a door and there are rooms beyond that and rooms beyond that, that you didn't know and wouldn't anticipate. There are people living in those rooms that you think you ought to know and all that sort of thing. That was my real introduction into the experience of writing as it is my experience. And I find that, whenever I'm writing, if I make the demand on myself to sort of know something out of common experience, I know it, typically I do. And I know it in detail. It's like when you have a dream and it's about a spider, and you realize from the dream that you know exactly how a spider moves, and exactly the sensation of those strange, omniscient sort of the gaze of the spider, but you find out, I think, from dreams as much as anything, that there are all kinds of things that in a remarkable detail that your consciousness has observed and saved, as if it's a sort of a secret sharer, partner of your existence. It's amazing, and it makes life much more interesting to realize that that you're simply much larger temporally and spatially in every other way than you might think. Somebody gonna, were you going to say something? Somebody made a sound?
Oh, I did.
Oh.
I think you're right, because how else would I have perceived that? Oh, that's exactly what it's like if it weren't there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
What do you do for research or revision?
I don't revise. I don't revise. I probably revise as I go. That's probably the secret to it, But I never outline a plot, although when I wrote Home, I knew that it had to basically track with Gilead, I try to write so that every sentence that I write seems as though it is as it ought to be before I write the next sentence or the next paragraph. And I will, take a week over a sentence, not that I'm revising it, but that I feel that it's unsatisfactory, and then I mull until something comes up that feels satisfactory. But it's sort of the metaphor that I use ad nauseum. But, when they were building the arch in St. Louis, and they kept sort of subtly miscalculating so that, and they had to basically do it over again so it was write at every point, you know. That's how it feels to me when I write, that you can build error into something and then it will feed, you know, it will have consequences as you go on.
Does this, I mean, you were mentioning that you were writing in a spiral notebook with your pen. How does that compare, say, if your students are typing on their computer and you can just continuously, like, revise ad nauseum? I mean, how do you compare that, or can you relate to the kind of writing that they do or their process?
Well, I don't talk to them too much about process. You know, I let Ethan talk to them about process. But, I mean, I really can't say any of the right things, you know, on the basis of my own belief and practice. But I don't know too much about their process. I think any serious writer settles into the process that's appropriate for her or his work, you know. And there's a real limit to how much they feel that they should be answering to some sort of pre-existing expectations. One of the things I find is that a surprising number of them do write in hand before they put it in the computer. I think one of the things, oddly enough, that has had consequences is that people stop teaching people to write cursively. And it's, yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you know, if the physical act of writing doesn't satisfy you, if it doesn't come easily, or if it's not pleasing when you've done it, I think that that's a disincentive to writing in hand. You know, I think that's a lot, the loss of the fluidity of the act, you know, is probably measurable in some way as far as people's preferences when they write.
It's almost a follow-up with that one. Is there a difference then between your process when writing nonfiction versus fiction? Or would you say it's all the same, where you want to make sure that first sentence and the subsequent one, the way you want it before you want the next one?
It's pretty close. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, you know, when you're writing nonfiction, there is a standard of reasonableness that you have to bring to bear. You know, do I have the right to say that? You know, can I support that? And that, of course, you know, leads to all sorts of, I mean, you write a sentence and you look at it and you think, now, where did that come from? You know, that's not something that I want to have to defend, you know, and then you do the research, if necessary, to figure out what causes the discomfort with what you've said.
When you're writing from beginning to end and you foreshadow or you allude to something that hasn't been revealed yet in the book, how do you, is that fully formed in your mind, like Jack Bouton's life and his wife and child? Did you know that before the character was introduced?
No. I didn't know. You know, it's a really, I mean, that's always such a question, you know, because the When I was writing Gilead, I wrote it as an effect of my having done a lot of research into the history of Iowa and the Middle West, because here I was and I knew nothing about the place. And one of the things that, of course, was very striking to me is that it has a very strong history of civil rights, you know. For example, it's very important to Gilead that there was never a miscegenation law, an anti-miscegenation law in Iowa. There are two states in the Union of which that is true. One is Maine, one is Iowa. It's a very exceptional, it's historically a very exceptional state in all sorts of ways, you know. But, you know, the people have forgotten that, you know. I mean, one of the things that, I'm a sort of missionary for the singularity of Iowa, you know, trying to convert Iowans to a degree of self-admiration that they are probably better for lacking, but in any case, you know, Jack Bouton knows that this is true. He knows about the abolitionist history of this, because his own family and so on, his own town are products of that. At the same time that, I mean, so in theory, he should be able to come home and establish his family in a way so that there are no social or, you know, police intrusions or, you know, ambiguities and so on. He should be able to marry his wife, in other words. But he doesn't, he can't work up the courage to actually tell his father why he has come home. You know, he finally ends up telling Ames. But his father, he doesn't know what his father thinks about anything like that, you know. I mean, he sees his father watching television and thinks. And then also his father is so frail. And So basically, he's the tattered moth returning to the shining star. And Ulysses Grant did call Iowa the shining star of radicalism. This was a state where banks were illegal because they encouraged the accumulation of capital. So, did I answer the question?
Yes.
In other words, I, as I wrote into this, I knew that was the crux. But how exactly it would work itself out as plot, I did not foresee.
One thing I talk to my students a lot about when we talk about novels is that it's easy to ascribe thematic intent to the writer,
mm-hmm.
when I'm not always sure that it's the case, that the writer intends certain themes to, but that they find them in some way. There are a lot of thematic arcs, one that you kind of just identified. But did you have, like to name the book Gilead, but at the same time, and knowing the history of Gilead being a place of healing and that kind of thing, were those ideas that were in your head as you began, or did they sort of reveal themselves as you went on, or?
well, you know, the book is actually modeled on the town of Tabor, Iowa, in southwest Iowa, which Tabor, Iowa apparently has made a 180-degree turn and is no longer the shining star of, you know, Fremont County radicalism. But in any case, it was actually founded by a colony of people from Oberlin College. Oberlin College was like this spores scattering out of it, you know, and Berea College, all kinds of things came out of Oberlin. But in any case, there's a man, was Reverend John Todd, who was a congregational minister and took a group of people there, and their purpose was to make a fallback for John Brown and Jim Lane. And so he had, 50 Sharps rifles in his cellar and a cannon in his barn. He was a very activist preacher. And in any case, these towns tended to have names that were biblical and that were statements of purpose. Tabor is a town in the Bible, and it's also a sort of a Hussite fortification city in Czechoslovakia, or whatever would be proper to call it now. And so the naming of the town is a statement of hope, you know, there's something that you find, or a statement of identity. Something that you also find are New England names and towns in Iowa and through the Middle West. And the reason for that is that, one reason for it is that churches in New England that were abolitionist would send a colony of their own members. And so that you have Amherst, Ohio, and all these kinds of things, you know. And they would start colleges, you know, as like Grinnell, for example. So, the thing that's touching to me about Gilead, it's associated on the one hand with healing, but the most famous passage is from Jeremiah, and he says, "Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no healing for my people there?" You know? And then if you think of that with the hymn, "There is a balm in Gilead," the counter-assertion, which very, you know, is very complex, very lovely. So I thought, and then there was no Gilead in Iowa. There are Gileads all over the country, but none in Iowa. So I thought it needed a Gilead.
So when you do your research, do you just kind of read and read and read, or do you actually kind of annotate and kind of, you know, almost like your dissertation, you know, like for your novel, that is?
Yeah. Well, you know, I have found, for example, you know, people are always thinking that I would keep journals, and I'm always getting journals for my birthday and things like that. And I find that I write completely stupid and off-putting things in my journals. There's a curse on me. But more, you know, you travel to an interesting place and you think, I will make notes on the vegetation, you know. And then you look at it and you think, oh, this is nonsense. But I've learned very much to trust my memory. what matters to me, I retain. And my, for whatever reason, my memory makes much better choices than present time makes for me, you know? And so, I mean, I'm sure I lose a lot and miss a lot, but I'm, you know, if something has the vitality of a retained memory, it means something to you, you know? I basically, when I do research, I buy every book that I can. Even Amazon does not have every book. But I like to own the book so that I can put stickers in it and write in the margins and all that sort of thing. That's really more the note-taking that I do than anything else.
I think you just describe a pretty unique style of a thought process when you approach writing. Doesn't seem to have a lot of structure, but it's very thoughtful. I was wondering if you think the ways in which you think that style of thinking, that approach to thinking, could help medical students. I think that I'm part of my education is being trained to think a certain way, to problem solve, I guess. And I like to participate in, we have a little writing group, because it's a different way of thinking. I don't know, maybe I don't have a clear question, but can you understand what I'm trying to communicate? Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts of how that approach to thinking can help enhance or improve, problem solving?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon that you read about the double helix, as being something that basically came out of a dream, as I understand it, the grand old twisted snake's dream, this man whose name I always forget, he's very well known, he's a physicist, he won a Nobel Prize, but he talks about, he solved some formula, something too abstruse for me to know how to admire him for it. But in any case, he said he wasn't thinking about it at all, and then he was stopped at a stoplight in Boston, and this solution came into his mind, And I think that very often that is how a certain kind of very scientific, very disciplined thinking does proceed. It's simply, it's like when you have to remember a telephone number, or there's a word that you absolutely want to use and you can't recover it, And then, 6 weeks later, when you've forgotten you ever needed it, boom, And, that if you give your mind a real problem, I think that your mind is working on it much more sort of holistically, much more actively over a big field of activity than we're in the habit of thinking. We think, all thinking happens in this little sort of frontal lobe. Although, frankly, the way the brain is, to talk about the scale of anything seems ridiculous because it's so complex that scale is not as we conventionally understand it. But, you hear all this stuff about how we only use a certain percentage of our brain and so on. I think that's absolutely not true, that it actually has a much fuller life, ergo we have a much fuller life than we are in the habit of understanding. I like to do other kinds of writing because I like to do other kinds of thinking than fiction. I'm very conscious of this. At the same time that I have, I have great respect for both experiences and I don't see them as either or. I think that the closer you could come to actually, the closer you could come to problem solving on the one hand and recruiting the whole of the history of the attention of your mind on the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what the people, the really creative thinkers, are actually doing. Yes?
What's your story? So you grew up in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of what would you say are the big mile markers along the way?
Well, I had a nice, I enjoyed my childhood in the sense that it was, my parents were middle class people, they had, it was like I was supposed to get straight A's. I was supposed to have good manners. Aside from that, just so long as I don't show up in the police log, I could pretty well do what I wanted. And I have a brother who's has always been very closely parallel to me in a way, and he painted and drew and so on while I wrote and read, and he read too, of course. And but he was my first critic, my first, you know, support, really. And I don't know to what extent I simply, you know, I was following him. I mean, he defined how, what was to be wonderful, and I, you know. And my parents would, if I, you know, I painted and drew and all those things too, and if whatever I wanted to do, my parents made sure that I had the physical means to do it. But I felt zero pressure, never any pressure, you know, aside from just high respectability. And then, you know, my brother went to Brown. He went to Brown because his best friend went to Harvard. He went to Brown because he wanted to study at the Rhode Island School of Design as well as do a regular BA. So I went to Brown because he liked it. And we were there. He was there as a senior and I was there as a freshman. And we used to walk around and around in the Providence rain. And he would fulminate to me about, you know, grand philosophy and so on. And I don't know what of it I have, maybe I've retained some of it, you know, I don't know. And go to that lovely little art museum in at Rhode Island School of Design. And all that was all very, very formative and important to me. I think it was true in an unusual degree that I was able to simply live into my own potentialities without anybody, you know, saying, well, you're never going to get a job if you do that, or any of the other coercive things that, you know, that are brought down on American youth these days and so on. And then also, you know, people, I mean, I did crazy, stupid things like playing in rock quarries and so on, you know, grappling down the walls, you know, to get to the little indentation that we call the cave and so on. I mean, but, you know, we were trusted to have better sense than we had. And I would just leave the house in the morning if it was a Saturday and come back for supper. And that was that. And so did all my friends. We were little feral children, and it was sublime.
I'm struck by the generational aspect of Gilead and how really four generations are covered over the course of the story. And one, how did you develop, I know you did your research, but did you put any of your own family aspect of it into the characters, or how did you define who they would be, all being from one lineage, but having very different ideas about the world?
Right. Well, I was the fourth generation in my family in the town that I lived in, which was really rare because it was like in back of beyond, you know, must have been one of the last states, but I did grow up knowing what my great grandfather did, what my grandfather did. You know what I mean? The idea of these kinds of narratives coming through generations like that, and that strange way that you have of identifying both with and against people that are given to you as being, you know, a heritage in some sense. You know. And then also I was so interested, you know, in Iowa history itself, the fact that people came here burning with intensity and did all kinds of pretty amazing things. And then over the course of time, they, you know, they don't just drift away from these. It's very complex because there are institutions in Iowa that are clearly a consequence of these beginnings. But people sort of aren't aware of them. They're just second nature, and they don't know where they came from, and they don't know there's much exceptional about them, and so on, you know. And so the drift of memory and how, what is retained and what is lost, and so on, very interesting to me.
Yeah, one of my favorite passages is when John Ames is giving his son the bread, and he gives it to him and feeds him to the mouth, and he said he imagines his father did that to him, but he knows he would not have, and how he shifts that memory, or how he wants to impart that on him, although it's different than what he received, but wanting to change that. And I guess, is that what you're saying? The drift, the changing of how things were done in the past, but shifting them into your own?
That, yeah. I mean that, and then I also mean Well, you know, what seems to have happened is that after the Civil War, which was a disaster, you know, I mean, absolutely necessary, absolutely disastrous, there was a huge surge of pacifism in this country. And you can understand why there would be, you know, because it took them years and years simply to bury the dead, you know. But the pacifism became a sort of amnesia about what the war had meant, other than the fact that, you know, 500 and some odd thousand people had died. And but there was huge resistance to the First World War on those grounds. And then we got talked out of our pacifism. That's another past that is forgotten, you know. So all those kinds of things, how, you know, these really very substantive shifts that occur and never occur as if people are saying, we have tried that and it failed, therefore we will try this, but just sort of being carried along in some inexplicable, you know, overturning that, you know, which seems to be sort of characteristic of our history, at least, that, you know, if you track American history, there will be a surge of one kind of thing and a falling back and a surge and a falling back. Can be. And then we have to start as if from the beginning, you know. I mean, there were schools, well, Oberlin being the great example, but, you know, lots of schools in the Middle West that were gender integrated in the 1830s and racially integrated in the 1830s. And then when I was in high school and it all started over again, it was like these things had not been tried. You know, I mean, just bizarre that Amherst, you know, practically bursting into flames over the fact that they would have women undergraduates. You know? Mm-hmm. That's very bizarre. And we, you know, there's this huge slippage. When you think of the country that we could have been if we simply hadn't lost grounds every, lost ground every 50 years.
So I'm definitely planning to reread Gilead, but I was wondering if you could elaborate on the relationship or comparison between John Ames and his older brother. You know, the older brother seems to be the radical of the family and goes off to Europe, kind of rejects what the family's tradition is. But I still didn't quite understand how John Ames came to just stay in the same town, even with this really powerful influence of his older brother, I guess.
Well, I mean, there are some people that are loyal and some people that feel as if loyalty is an unacceptable constraint. You know, I think you just see that in families, you know. I mean, especially if a family where the religious culture is an important part of it, there are always people, perpetuators and, you know, renegades or whatever you want to call them. And that, you know, it happens to have been true in that way in John Ames' own experience, but I think it's not anything that's time-specific, really. People, they're always the doubters and the departers, you know.
I'd like to ask a question about religion, and if I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about, it's because I really don't know. Okay. So there are two characters in the book. I can't remember their names. I think it's John Ames' father and John Ames' grandfather, right? And John Ames' grandfather is like this really radical reverend who is trying to help black slaves escape slavery and is involved in a lot of radical movement, I think. And at one point he's waving a gun in the church and has a bloody t-shirt. And he and his son have this really big argument about the presence of God in, from their perspectives. So one man feels that he is doing what God wants him to do by helping these people and engaging in violence. And the other person, his son feels that Jesus is not in the activities that you are doing. I don't see Jesus' presence there at all. And so these are two really different interpretations of God or Jesus or some sort of element of spirituality. And in your book, I don't think that you fall on either side of what's the right interpretation or not. I think that it's like it's a theme that you see a lot even today, just anywhere between religions or within religion, you know, within a religion. And what do you make of all of these different interpretations? How do they reconcile? Can they?
Well, you know, when I started doing the research that turned out to be Gilead, the reason for that was because I was disturbed by the present course of human history, and I wanted to identify people for my purposes who seemed to me to understand and react appropriately to the moment in which they lived, you know. And you know, I'm very theological, you know. So two of them were Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who were very closely associated in the Second World War, the period leading up to and including the Second World War. And they organized everything they could in the way of resistance to Hitler. And Bonhoeffer was killed by the Nazis, and Barth was not, because he was simply deported because he was Swiss and had a huge international reputation. Apparently, they could only kill one theologian at a time. But but in any case, they acted beautifully and wrote beautifully under extraordinary pressure. Barth actually attacked Hitler on the radio after Hitler had come to power. And but there they were. And then the other people that seemed to me to understand and act were the abolitionists, the American abolitionists. They were, a lot of them came from Yale. There were two groups, especially of divinity students, the Yale Band and the Iowa Band, they were called, that came right here. And what they did was found colleges, and among other things, but they were very smart. They were very intentional. They would buy land from the government. This is before the Homestead Act. They'd buy land from the government. Then they would build a church and start a college. And then people who came into that part of the country would want to buy land around them because everybody wanted a church and a college, you know. And then they could use the money to develop the church or the college, and also to start a seed money to do the same thing elsewhere. One of the things that was characteristic of these colleges is that there was no tuition, because they were what were called manual labor system schools. So it was Mount Holyoke College. Practically every overwhelmingly expensive school you can think of was a manual labor system in the beginning. But the idea was that people ought to do the work for themselves that was involved in their, you know, in their thriving. And so these little colleges, villages, were places where the university president would, you know, slaughter the hogs, and the professor of divinity would chop the weeds and so on. And all the undergraduates, all the faculty, everybody did farm work to sustain these. And they also, this is a very characteristic repeated pattern, they also set up printing presses. And they would print off abolitionist material to disseminate as widely as they could. And they sent so much of it into the South that sometimes the postmaster would simply burn the mail, because the percentage of it that was abolitionist literature was so high that he wasn't going to bother sorting through it. Another thing that they did was they of course, these are all religious people, you know, and they had this missionary model of what to do. So they would send people out into the countryside to convert towns to abolition. And extraordinary people. I mean, and they would be mobbed. They'd be beaten. They would be, you know, everything you can think of. And they would stay there and preach every night until they had converted the town. They would do this over and over and over again. And they succeeded, you know. I mean, the Middle West was solidly unionist, solidly anti-slavery, you know, Abraham Lincoln and Sherman and Grant and all these people came right out of the Middle West, out of that culture. And, you know, I mean, it's extraordinary. One of the things that the South was so eager to do before the Civil War was push slavery up the Mississippi River and make it so that anyone that was a slaveholder could take slaves into any state without reference to the laws that prevailed there, you know. So to secure the Middle West was strategically absolutely crucial. And that's what they set out to do, and that's what they did, you know? And the, all these kind of work ethic things and so on that are so characteristic of this region come directly out of this ethos, you know, that you don't let somebody else carry your weight, you know? I mean, it's quite a beautiful, it's a beautiful narrative, you know? And one that I hope to revive, help revive, you know? It doesn't, there are archives in this part of the world. You know, I went to Jackson, Illinois, Illinois University was one of, or Illinois College was one, like the first college founded west of the Mississippi. And the president was Edward Beecher, the big brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe and so on. There was a famous martyrdom there of a man named Josiah Lovejoy. And I talked at Illinois College. I go to these places if they invite me because, you know, my own interests. I said, you know, you must have wonderful archives here. And the man I was talking to said, oh, you know, there's some old guy sorting through some things in boxes, you know. Ah, you know, they could have letters from Tolstoy. They could, you know, the Beechers were the most plugged in people in the world. You know, who knows what's out there? Because for some reason, some evolution occurred where people stopped valuing in so many ways something that's so extraordinarily valuable.
It's really interesting, like, when I talk to a lot of students about Gilead, a lot of people react to it as sort of a religious, a book about religion. Mm-hmm. But yet, I've read it several times now, and I still don't necessarily read it that way. And listening to you talk about that idea of religion as, and testifying and preaching as a way to make social change is really interesting to me. I guess I'm curious, since you say you want to help revive a, you know, a sense of this, like, do you see an analog to that in the modern age, in our time?
Not in this moment, I don't. And that's, I probably wouldn't say that if I were more, you know, I mean, I travel around a lot. One of the things that is a sort of privilege of my life is that I do get to go to a lot of places in this huge and populous country, you know, and see what people are doing. And what happens on the ground is quite extraordinary. And you know, again, it's that, you know, the problem of some kind of consciousness where, you know, you go to some place and you find, you know, a really fundamentalist college that has spent endless money becoming geothermal, you know, and it's a 19th century school, so you can imagine. And they have a system where the more fuel efficient your car is, the closer you get to park to your office. And all these very shrewdly worked out sort of green things, you know. You know, I mean, it's like, of course there are things that one might take exception to, but we have this way of sort of painting everything over as if we don't have anything to learn, you know, or as if everybody that is over some imaginary line is inimical and not to be respected, you know. It's a sad thing. I mean, if we could just have more conversation and less, you know, this barking over boundaries and so on, it would be, the country would feel very different. You go to places like Texas, you know, I was at Baylor, and, you know, I mean, to an Iowa accustomed eye, that looks like no place you could grow anything, you know. But what they have done is put a great deal of effort and science and everything else into developing techniques for dryland farming. And what they do is they replicate circumstances that you would find in, you know, Afghanistan or somewhere, you know, any place where water is a problem, so that they can, and then they bring in people from those countries and they work with them, you know, in this type of agriculture. What a good idea, you know. And then down the road there's a kind of a scary cult and so on, you know. But if we were just aware of it, I mean, a lot of people anywhere are doing smart, interesting things, and we're not having the advantage of it.
Do you think that's part and parcel to, as you said, the American culture seems to reinvent itself with every generation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's part and parcel to the inability to communicate? I mean, we don't build on our successes intellectually.
Yeah, that's very true. Absolutely. I mean, what we do is we develop this sort of trash consciousness that is television and all the rest of it, you know, that is, seems to be a way to make us, it seems to obstruct rather than to enhance mm-hmm. communication. And then it creates a sort of desolate feeling that there's really nothing to communicate anyway, you know. It's a pity. And, you know, I don't have to tell you what side I am on as far as the gun debate is concerned. And I keep getting invited to these highly conservative places. And I go there and I say, this is a disaster. It is, if you're going to talk about the Bible, this is completely unsustainable in biblical terms, you know. And I have never gotten a hostile response. And I typically get questions like, how did we get in this situation? And I'm talking about Texas, you know, or Michigan, you know, and it tends to be true that I am the first person that has come to them and said what I think candidly, you know, in good faith, you know. And then there's the other part of the reason I started going to all these conservative colleges, really, you know, fundamentalist, is that I got an invitation from a meeting of conservative theologians. That's how they define themselves. And I looked down the names and I thought, you know, these are not my people. You know what I mean? I don't know how I would talk theology here. And, it's a fair, you know, anxiety, I suppose. But so I declined, and then I got another invitation from them, and I declined. And then I got a letter saying, we are all very conservative and we need another voice. And I thought, I have hung out with liberals my whole life and I have never heard them say, we're all very liberal, we need another voice, you know? And, you know, I mean, there's more out there and different, it's different. It's not what we are encouraged by our niche communication systems to suppose. Oh, I went, and they had composed music to introduce the lecture. I've never ever, and I got a standing ovation. I have never been more cordially received.
Is it a dignitary or a, you know, from a foreign country?
Exactly, whatever it takes.
Maybe that's how the conservatives do it. The liberals are just too lazy with their, you know, thing to, like, make a big stink about it. We ordered food.
What did you learn about that? Do you think that, like, if they really wanted you to come, but I don't know, I gave Gilead to the parents of my boyfriend who are fundamentalist Christians, and part of that is because we don't talk about politics or religion. We only talk about movies and restaurants and stuff like that. And I'd like to have kind of a better relationship with them. And I'd like to be able to talk about these things. So I got his father this book and said, I'm reading this too. Maybe we can talk about it because there are many references to the Bible that I don't know what they're referring to. And we haven't, that was in Christmas, and we haven't met yet, but I'm certain that we're going to talk about it. And I'm glad I made the step, but I'm also nervous because this isn't an area that I know anything about. But at the very least, I'd like to be able to talk about it since it's a huge part of their lives. What did you learn about going to conservative fundamentalist colleges to talk about religion?
Well, you know, it might not, you know, I mean, obviously I want to take as positive a view of these things that, but it seems to me as if there's a difference between the audience and the leadership that they accept. You know, I mean, people say the most amazing things to me, like, why didn't the churches do anything to stop the Iraq War? Now, I didn't expect to hear that in a conservative, you know, seminary in Michigan. And then they would say things like, we always get little snippets you know, people are never talking coherently about what the whole text is saying and all the rest of it, you know? So it seems like a kind of group loyalty that also manifests itself at the polls in all sorts of ways. But nevertheless, if they're speaking without accepting the discipline of the group, in effect, that you find they're thinking completely other things than you would imagine. And I don't know, I don't understand that. I mean, because often they see themselves as people that are rebellious, you know? I don't understand it. But in any case, you just have to take what you can from the fact that they seem open to conversation, that they are, in many ways, within their world, extraordinarily generous, amazingly generous. You know, I mean, it's if we could just find some way to take the good and minimize, you know, put make the bad into something we could actually talk about, you know.
What would you recommend? You talked about the trash consciousness problem. What would you recommend as nutritious reading?
Oh, my goodness.
Or watching. What would be a reading list you would recommend?
Oh, you know, so many people have asked me for reading lists lately. It's kind of, this is the third one. But, well, you know, you sort of, I mean, you know, it's always, you know, it's helpful to read Aristotle's Metaphysics or, you know, I mean, I like to read, because I write scriptural and theological things, I read a lot of deep antiquity, you know, Hammurabi's Code and the Egyptian Book of the Dead and all these things. You know, it's sensitizes you to for one thing, the great brevity of human presence on the earth. On the other hand, the incredibly unambiguously human quality of these very, very distant voices. You know, the Egyptian pharaoh celebrating the beauty of a chick coming out of an egg. You know, and it stands on its feet, he says. but any of these books that are in the sort of theoretical curriculum, you know, Voltaire or Shakespeare or whoever, they're all good for you. They all broaden the world for you, you know. For my students, I'm always trying to sort of re-educate them in a sense, because very often they have not read books that they feel that they ought to have read. They don't give references and they know they're missing them. And it makes them cautious. It makes them write in a smaller way than they would otherwise do, you know. So I'm always trying to encourage them to, you know, if you haven't read fill in the blank, Capital, for heaven's sakes, read it, you know. It's you're putting ground under your feet if you simply know what it is that people are talking about, and if you can find out when they don't know what they're talking about too.
I have a question about, it's not philosophical, it's not in, but when you wrote Gilead,
mm-hmm.
and did it just feel unfinished? Were those characters still just there saying, wait, you forgot?
Exactly. Well, I didn't exactly feel that I'd forgotten, but I did feel there, you know, that, as I was saying at the beginning, you get this very strong sense of a person, you know? And after I'd written Housekeeping, those people were in my mind for a long time. And it was like mourning or something, the idea that, you know, they're done with me, I'm done with them. But I, you know, I simply waited until they faded away, which took a long time. And then when I had the same feeling after Gilead, I thought, why am I doing this, you know? There they are, and they want their book, you know?
Are they still wandering?
Oh, you just have to wait. One thing about Faulkner with his Jakna Patafa, you know, he puts all these similar characters in the same landscape and so on. I feel he's given me great latitude as far as that's concerned.
I guess I have further questions back to religion. So I'm from the Midwest and I come from an extremely religious family, but I'm not religious myself. But, you know, especially my father's family is sort of one of these sort of activist Protestant from Ohio groups, and then my mother's family sort of more modern evangelical Christians. And I was so struck in your books about sort of the poignancy of religion as a comfort, but as also not a comfort, or sort of people who are losing maybe their personal immediate faith, but sort of continue to observe the sacraments, and how that's sort of a double-edged sword of both a comfort and a loss. But then people who put that aside for maybe rational reasons or personal reasons, how that is also both a comfort to be living as you feel you should be living, but also a loss of the sacrament and the community of religious faith. And I guess so it's not really a question, but it resonated so strongly with me in these stories that even those who we see from the outside as being deeply within a religion can also still feel that loss. And those people who seem, you know, staunch atheists from the outside still have very religious, those feelings and those needs are still there.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's certainly, and you know, one of the things that's just historically interesting is that for so long, religious faith was socially reinforced, you know. I mean, even to the point of being burned at the stake if you seem to have too many questions and that sort of thing. And so we can't look back and know, we can't, you know, if there's the apparent conformity to religious belief at an earlier point, we don't know how authentic it was. We can't tell, you know. And you just, you know, people talk about religion and they talk about belief and so on. I don't know what these words even mean. You know what I mean? It's sort of like when people talk about, was Faulkner Christian or not, you know? And he said, well, you know, yes and no, I suppose, or something like that, you know? But who even knows from one day to the next what a state of belief will be, or whether religious understanding will become important as a way of resolving something that can't be resolved in any other terms, or, you know? For me, you know, I have a very strong theological, you know what I mean? A very strong theological interest. And it has been true for so long, and it is so important to me, that it is the form that my thought takes, you know? And I can't, you know, I mean, it's not like I'm dealing with a factual question. It's like I am testing a worldview that is fruitful when I test it over and over and over again, you know? And that might not satisfy some people's notion of religion. I don't think we ever know what it means to one person or another. I tend to, you know, I tend to respect it a priori, you know, and at the same time assume that it always is a difficult thing for people to firmly experience as being. I think a lot of the sort of hardline religion is actually anxiety that comes from the fact that religion itself as a state of mind is a difficult thing to sustain and to understand even, you know.
So I have one last question. And then, but it goes back to something that Allison mentioned about her relationship with her boyfriend's father. And something I think that speaks to a larger subject that you were talking about is that idea of, well, the idea of ideas. And I guess to me it seems like cordial ignorance, like that we won't allow ourselves to talk amongst ourselves about the more difficult things, gun reform, always, you know, if you talk about something that's highly charged, it degrades into either cordiality for the sake of not arguing,
right,
or arguing without logic.
Right.
How, you know, and I mean, that exists on almost every level of discussion, and where to me the whole idea is that we should talk about things in the greatest detail and hash over them. I talk, you know, education in our community or anything like that. But how would you encourage people to foster that kind of discussion? I mean, it seems like religion was, like you say, was sort of a part of our culture. And by being part of our culture, it allowed us to have a discourse about difficult things without overstepping some sort of social boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So how, in a more secular culture now, how do we engage in the discussion of ideas?
Well, you know, I think part of, I mean, I belong to a very liberal Protestant tradition. And the, you know, in terms of how it situates itself in the world, I utterly approve. But it seems to me almost amazing that it succeeds in doing that consistently, because people have lost the habit of, or it seems to me relatively, the churches themselves have lost the habit of reasonably, humanely, thoughtfully opening the questions that face the culture. You know, you have people ranting on one hand, and you have people talking about, when my boy was 13, he said the cleverest thing, on the other hand, you know. and it's, although, you know, there's a Chinese lawyer that goes to my church, and he said, the reason that we don't have to have an authoritarian government is because the churches teach us how to act. Which I think is a lovely thought, you know, I don't know, but, you know, generosity, nonviolence, and all those kinds of things. But I think that there has been, it's a strange thing, like secularism, you know. Secularism is a sound, fruitful thing. I think that the reason that so many religious cultures in this country have flourished to the extent that they have, and this is so rare in the world, is because we actually have an open space that's shared by everybody. You know, nobody's going to ask for your theological credentials, except now they're beginning to do that if you run for office or something, you know. But the understanding that insofar as possible, every aspect of the culture should be equally open to every presence in the culture, I think is a wonderful thing. And I don't, you know, if secularism is skepticism or hostility to religion, you know, then that's another question, although it's a perfectly legitimate question in its own terms. But to confuse the, you know, the utter open access that the culture develops on the one hand with hostility to religion, it seems to me it's a sort of, it's a very, very sad slide in the meaning of the word. I think we should protect secularism in order to protect religion, you know?
I think dialogue within the religious community is also an echo chamber, just as much as it is within any other community. So within any one church can often be failure to talk about ideas, just as you might see. And I think you need the dialogue between groups to get the fundamental questions out there. I don't think churches are any better at addressing the big ideas than any kind of secular bake sale organization either, you know, like.
Yeah. I feel like there should be an avenue where someone like Allison could feel comfortable engaging in a challenging conversation with her boyfriend's father, who holds different views than she does, without, you know, like the conversation shouldn't have to default to movies and restaurants.
Right.
You know?
Like the avenue, maybe, you know how this semester we're talking about poetry, and I don't know very much about that either, but I'm starting to grasp the concept of an ephemeral plane where you kind of, you understand without explicitly being told something. You're communicating something, or someone is communicating to you, but in uncertain terms, but you get it. So I think that the prose in this book has that quality. We've talked about this in class, and so I thought that maybe that would be an avenue, like some plane that he and I could meet on, just to talk, to enrich our relationship. So hopefully it'll work. I gave that to him in December. He's a banker. It's taken a while for him to get through, but I think he's through it. We'll meet again at the end, May
18th. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, Marilyn, thank you for being here today.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it very much.
Thanks for listening to The Short Code. The Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from medical student government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, too, where we post not only our episodes, but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas and the occasional rant from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The executive producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by Revolution Void.